For novelist and veteran river paddler Peter Heller, rivers are like fiction.
What was so cool about running lots of rivers in remote places that often had whitewater is that it's like a narrative. I mean, you put on the river, the current takes you into some new territory where you've never been. Things happen, there's story, and you come around a tight bend in a gorge or, you know, in a canyon, and you're always surprised.
We talk with Peter Heller about his terrific new novel, a thriller set on a river above the Arctic Circle. It's called The River. Then we re-air our 2017 interview with historian Timothy Snyder about his cautionary tale about the descent into authoritarianism. The book is On Tyranny. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Novelist Peter Heller is a master of lyrical descriptions of nature combined with heart-thumping thrillers. The best-selling author of The Dog Stars, he's now come out with a new story about two college students on a wilderness canoe trip, a trip that was supposed to be a bucolic journey down the Maskwa, one of Canada's most beautiful and remote rivers. But that ends up being threatened by dangers both natural and man-made. It's a gripping tale of a friendship tested by fire, white water, and violence. The Wall Street Journal called it one of the 10 books you'll want to read this spring. Heller tells us about the connections between his own life and the story that unfolds in the river in this highly personal and engaging interview. Well, Peter Heller, welcome to Writer's Voice. You know, I'm so glad that we are talking because I have long wanted to talk with you about your wonderful novels, and this one was really terrific, just spellbinding, not only because the story itself is a kind of thriller, but also because of the beauty of the descriptions of the natural world. And you were an editor for Outside Magazine, right?
I was a contributing editor, which doesn't really mean anything except that they'll probably answer your phone calls when you have a story idea. But I did write for Outside for a long time, 20-something years, doing expedition stories and environmental stories.
I guess your first book was about an expedition, a paddling expedition. This book is a tale of two young men, best friends, who go on a paddling expedition in the Maskwa River. Is that how you pronounce it, in northern Canada?
Sure, yeah.
And your first book was about paddling a river in Tibet, Hell or High Water. So first of all, before we get into the meat of the book, talk to us a little bit about what paddling means to you.
I'm a water person, sort of like a little otter. And ever since I was, tiny, I just loved being in the water and, getting thrashed by waves, learning to body surf when I was probably five. And I always just felt really comfortable in the water. And I love it. And I feel like as soon as I get in water or on water in a boat, all the sort of normal natural laws seem to tempt the normal rhythms of life seem to vanish. And you get in a boat, you pull away from shore, you're buoyant. All of a sudden you're being rocked and moved by, much different rhythms and cadences than you are on land. And I just love that ability to transport to another world. I've always loved it. So rivers, especially when I started kayaking, I started canoeing, as a kid, and started doing whitewater in college. And what was so cool about running lots of rivers in remote places that often had whitewater is that it's like a narrative. I mean, You put on the river. The current takes you into some new territory where you've never been. Things happen. There's story. And you come around a tight bend in a gorge or, you know, in a canyon, and you're always surprised. You can be scared or thrilled. There might be a waterfall or a cougar drinking or a flight of swallows. And to me, you know, it was just always such an adventure and always so thrilling to be on rivers. And it's a great way to travel into wild country and quiet. You know, when you come around that bend, you're not making the noise that you would make when you're walking or, you know, biking or anything else. So I always loved it. And I think it is a really nice sort of metaphor for narrative.
I can really relate to that. I was very lucky to take a trip down the Colorado River now many years ago. And I remember confronting my own terror of anticipation because there's a very big falls. I've forgotten the name of it now.
Lava.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And I was just so scared for the days leading up to that. There were nights that I couldn't sleep. I was just sure that, you know, something terrible was going to happen. But I had a very skilled person who was leading the expedition and was the person who was guiding the boat, the raft that I was in. And we made it. And it was the experience of anticipating something that was so frightening and yet going through with it in spite of it that was such a growing experience for me.
Isn't that great? You know, I've paddled that, like, kayaked that like 8 times, sometimes with a boat full of gear, you know, just self-support. But it's that, you remember that feeling of when you know, when the raft, you were probably riding a raft, right? And the raft pulled out. And you were committed, you know, you were in the main current and you were committed and you just had to let go and surrender to the experience. You know, that's the cool thing about river running. You know, you make that commitment and then it's all action. And all that anticipation just vanishes in crashing waves. And it's a thrill. That's great.
Yeah, that's for sure. And so now to this book, The River. So I mentioned before, it's about two young men who are best friends, who college friends on a wilderness canoe trip. Tell us first about these two main characters, Wynn and Jack.
Yeah, so Jack is a ranch kid from western Colorado near Kremling. He is tough the way ranch kids are tough. He and his dad run this little ranch. He spent, you know, half his life in the saddle and making breakfast over a campfire and sleeping out under the stars are second nature to Jack. You know, he's kind of tough that way. Cold, hunger, rain, snow, they're not good or bad to Jack. They just are. And if you get through them, it's good. And he's a little wary of people. You know, he sort of is sort of like a little bit skeptical about people. He suffered a terrible tragedy, which I won't, you know, spoil, when he was 11, kind of the worst you can suffer. And it's made him wary of the world. And he's sort of spent a lot of time reading, voracious reader, and fly fishing and working in the saddle. Wynn is really different. He's a gentle giant. He's 6'5". He's an architect, some from Vermont, and he loves nothing more than to make ephemeral art, you know, sort of a la Goldsworthy, out of sticks and stones and feathers. And he's an artist, but he also is a consummate outdoorsman, as is Jack, and is a very, very fine paddler and fisherman. And these guys share together a deep love of books and literature and of the outdoors, more than just the, you know, sport aspect of it. They both are you know, deeply enamored of nature in all her colors. And so they have this bond, and they met on freshman trip at college, and they're now juniors, and they're best friends.
And there is a very stark difference between them, between their characters. They're both, you know, ethical people. No, I don't mean to say one is unethical, the other ethical, but they really have a different take on the world. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, and I sort of forgot to mention in describing Wynn that he, unlike Jack, expects the best of everybody. He's sort of like, you know, a black lab, you know, the way they run up to you with tail wagging, no matter who you are. And so Wynn is like that. You know, he really does live in a very, you know, in a positive world. And Jack, on the other hand, is sort of like, you know, prove it. Are you a good person? Prove it to me. I don't need to have much to do with you if you're not. So, yeah, they have very different approaches, and they balance each other. And the other things about them is the other thing about them is that they have done lots of mountain expeditions together, lots of river expeditions, and they have at times different tolerances for risk. You know, one will be a little bit more conservative than the other at times, one more brash, and so they balance each other out.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Peter Heller, author of The Dog Stars, about the new novel he's just come out with. It's called The River. You know, without giving anything away, this difference between them becomes quite salient in this book, The River. Yeah, it becomes quite salient between them. So without giving away anything, I wonder if you could talk about that tension and how you use that in the narrative. And also, I guess I'm curious, do you lean more one way or the other in terms of this sense of the safety versus the lack of safety in the world?
Right. Well, that's a good question. I think I'm maybe trying to answer that in the book, as we do as novelists. Yeah, I mean, the way it plays out, I mean, is character fate? Not sure, but these guys on the river, you know, they think they're going to go off on a really relaxing month or so long canoe trip, you know, down a river that flows out of a string of lakes, flows north a couple of hundred miles through really remote wilderness into Hudson Bay, you know, where the polar bears are and all. And it's rarely run, this river. It ends at a little Cree village on the coast. And they expect, you know, they get their canoe flown in to one of these lakes on a float plane, and they expect to just paddle, pick blueberries, maybe hunt, fish, and relax. And they don't set an end date, which they've never done before. They figure when they get to the village, they'll call the plane to pick them up. And so in this way, they just feel like they want to just immerse themselves in these natural rhythms. They even leave their watches, and they have no satellite phone either. But they do have a rifle. And so right away they encounter two Texans who are camped out on an island who are pretty much three or five sheets to the wind already in the morning, and have guns and make misogynistic comments and seem a little bit maybe dangerous or menacing. And they, you know, they encounter these guys right away. And so Jack's reaction is, you know, they're worthless. Wynn is, you know, trying to see good in these guys. And pretty soon they encounter another couple of people. And I don't guess I should tell the plot. But in these encounters, it becomes very, very clear that Wynn just wants to help out, and, you know, and Jack is really wary of, you know, ulterior motives and, you know, other agendas that might be beneath the surface. And I guess, you know, it's interesting that we're having this interview right now, because this morning, one of my best, dearest old friends just left. We skied together the last few days, and he's Wynn. His name is Jay Mead. He's an ephemeral artist in Vermont. He's 6'5", towers over me. And we've done lots and lots of there's a scene in the book where the two boys meet on their freshman orientation trip. It's a backpacking trip in the White Mountains, and they're so excited about books, and they're talking about books and art and fishing that they outstrip the group they're with. They ramble ahead by, you know, a couple miles, and that was a real scene, you know, with this guy Jay, that, you know, he became one of my dearest friends on the first day of school. And he's like Wynn, you know, he expects the best of everyone. And I guess I'm a little more like Jack. I'm not nearly as tough, but I'm a little more wary.
Yeah. And again, without going into the plot, because we don't want to spoil it for anyone, you have Wildfire as a kind of character in this book, and I wonder if you could talk about it. It's almost like a deus ex machina, something that's looming from afar. So tell us about this non-human character in your book.
To me, the fire is, you know, maybe the major character because it's so big and it's so threatening and it's getting closer and closer and these guys are racing the clock, you know, trying not to be in its path when it comes. And it just gives just the smell of the smoke at times and the sight of it, you know, when you climb a tree or a hill and see it sort of fluttering and breathing on the horizon, bigger than anything they could have ever imagined. You know, it seems like it takes up two quadrants and the biggest forest fire that, you know, they've ever seen. And it's blowing right towards them. So, you know, it does wind, you know, it certainly winds up the engine of the plot for sure. And, you know, I didn't even mean it to. You know, I always start books with a first line, and I came up as a poet. I'm almost more interested in the music of the language than the plot. You know, I sort of start with the first line. I love the sound of it, and I follow it into the second and third and follow the cadence and the rhythm of the language and ride those on, you know, sort of the story rides the back of the music. And so I began the book with the first line, they've been smelling smoke for 2 days. And I didn't even know, you know, why I'd written that. And pretty soon there were these two guys, you know, and they were in a canoe and they were on an island and they'd been lifting their noses like coyotes, you know, the last couple of days, smelling the smoke. And not just in morning or evening, you know, when it might have been another group's campfires, but in the middle of the day. And so one evening they climb a hill and they see it laying, you know, the glow of it laying, you know, in the dusk, and it frightens them to the bone. And so, you know, there we are, and I was off. And I realized, I think, as I wrote, that I was probably working through something that happened to me years ago. In 1994, I was living in a little western town, a town in western Colorado, and it was the same weekend that the Storm King fire in Glenwood Springs killed 14 wildland firefighters. It was the same droughty, hot weekend, and it was just over the mesa to the south from where those guys died. And I saw a column of smoke from my house. I thought it was my friend Chuck's house. I threw a chainsaw on the truck and a shovel, and I bolted down there. The emergency crews were at the big canal at the bottom of the hill, steep hill, rutted track. And they said, you can't go up there. There's a fire. By now it was a wall of smoke. The column had turned. It was all pinyon juniper woods on the steep hill. And so I ran up the road with just the shovel, and there were just a few people up there running art and cats and stuff into vehicles. And there was a volunteer fire truck, and all of a sudden, the wall of smoke turned into a wall of flame, and I heard the trees exploding, you know, as in the book. And the firefighter said, you know, we're out of here, and they cut their hoses. And we all had this line of cars going down this dirt track. I was in the lead one with Claudette, C-L-A-W, the cat, running laps, you know, in the cabin. And we were going through sparks and flames and smoke, and we got to the bottom of the hill and look back, and about 90 seconds later, a gust flat out of the west took the fire over that whole hillside, just swept the entire ridge. So, you know, I mean, we were, you know, minute and a half, 2 minutes from just being toast. And it's those kinds of experiences, I think, that when we write fiction, they kind of flutter in out of the dark and land on your keyboard. And they're these things that made a deep impression on you, you know, maybe that I needed to work through.
Well, that's quite a description there. Yeah, you know, that's interesting. You talk about that happened in 1994. And of course, you know, wildfire is a feature of the West, not just the West, other places as well. But when I read this, you know, this is a time of climate chaos, a time of wildfire. Just a few weeks ago, Australia was burning, you know, the continent was burning. So, of course, I thought of that. I thought of this looming sense of danger that we live with, or many of us live with every day, just that sense of foreboding. And I also thought of your other, the other novel.
Dog Stars, yeah.
Exactly, The Dog Stars, which is, you know, set in a time when most of the world has perished from a flu pandemic, and here we are in the midst of a coronavirus pandemic. So I wonder, this sense of foreboding, is that something that you feel and that also comes in and lands on the keys of your keyboard?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I'm not a depressed person. I'm very ebullient and an exuberant sort of person. But at the same time, ever since I was old enough to really be conscious, I remember being 12, and I remember there was this read in the New York Times when I was 12 that about the issues that were most important for Americans, and they had the percentages, and I remember the environment was number 7 or something. And I remember thinking when I was 12 years old, I thought that's odd, because without the environment, all these other ones above are moot. you need an ecosphere to have an economy. And so I think I've been aware, I've just been, I just love nothing more than being out in wild country and being in nature. And so I've been really, attuned and listening to the natural world for a long time, ever since I was a little kid. And the smells and the birds and the migrations and the weather. And, the fact that we're in the middle of the sixth great mass extinction right now and that we caused it, I mean, it really hurts my feelings. I mean, it's more than a crime what we're doing. I think it's a sin. I mean, we're taking, in our heedlessness, we're taking, millions of other species that have no voice into the dark. And I don't get it. And I feel it. And so at the same time as I just love being out in the world and I have joy on rivers and I have joy in the mountains and in the ocean, I feel every day these accelerating losses. And I think we all do. And I think it's the root of the anxiety that, so many teenagers have now. It's the growing, pandemic of anxiety. And I think everybody feels the losses. I don't think you need to know the statistics, And so I think as an artist, you can't just play the violin on the deck of the Titanic, as it sinks. I think as an artist, you can't help but wrestle with, grapple with those big, big emotional and spiritual challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. You said it hurts your feelings. I totally understand that, because it physically hurts me when I think exactly of what you say. All these creatures who, are completely innocent, they had nothing to do with this. And of course, most humans have had nothing, to create the system that is allowing this or driving this to happen. And so that is such a painful thing. So I wanted to ask, how do you resolve this? I mean, does the fiction, some people take the refuge in maybe joining an organization or marching in the street. You write this wonderful fiction that is so steeped in the beauty of the natural world. Is this something that you do also to heal yourself in this time of anxiety?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's so much about healing in that. I mean, that might be, I think, probably, a collateral effect. But when I sit down at the coffee shop, I put on headphones and I listen to rain with thunder. And it's sort of, and then the coffee shop falls away. And as a fiction writer, the most wonderful, magical thing is that I can go anywhere my heart leads or my nose. And oftentimes, I can go anywhere I really want to be. And oftentimes I want to be in nature. I want to be in wild country. I want to be knee deep in a mountain creek, or I want to be on the ocean, or, in the woods. And I want to see a spider web. I want to see a spider weaving her web in the roots of a cut bank by a creek, or, listening to the wind in the spruce. And So I go there because I can, because I love it, and I'm, and it overwhelms me, and it fills my heart so much that I could hardly bear it sometimes, and I love it, and you know, why not?
Well, the novel is The River. I highly recommend it to all our listeners. It is spellbinding. Peter Heller, thank you so much for this terrific conversation.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks, Francesca.
Peter Heller is the author of 7 books, including the nonfiction Hell in High Water and the novel The Dog Stars. Find an audio excerpt from The River at writersvoice.net. Next up, Timothy Snyder on tyranny. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. In 2017, we talked with historian Timothy Snyder about his book On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. The book was intended as a kind of vaccine to inoculate us against acquiescing to authoritarianism. In the years since its publication, signs of our slide toward autocracy in the U.S. have only increased, and the main preventive Snyder identifies against that slide, the resistance by an authoritarian leader's own party to his assaults on democracy, have not materialized. We thought this would be a good time to hear that interview again. Well, Timothy Snyder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Very glad to be with you.
Your book On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, begins with the idea that history does not repeat, but it does instruct. Talk about the difference between those two things.
So I start with the notion of repetition because I'm trying to open up American minds to how history might be useful. When we compare the U.S. to darker periods of European history, or when we even invoke European history to talk about the U.S., the reflexive American response is to say, is it exactly like that? And of course, it's never exactly like that. The United States in 2017 is obviously not exactly like, for example, Germany in 1933. But that, as I see it, is a kind of laziness on our part. We've ceased to think historically about most things, and we kind of flatter ourselves by saying, well, I've just tested to see whether it's exactly the same. It's not exactly the same, therefore we can move on. That's the way the American mind processes, or rather doesn't process, history. What I'm trying to say is that history instructs. That is, if you know a whole lot of different examples, you can find patterns that will be present today, or you can recognize a historical moment in which some elements are similar, or you can identify with someone who experienced something which is a bit like your own predicament, perhaps more intense, and who left behind a useful record of what he or she went through and what he or she can now recommend. So I'm trying to say that history instructs in the sense that if we go back and broaden our imaginations, we'll be able to understand our own moment better and to act in it better. Now, there's also a darker version of history instructs, which is that it's quite clear that some people who are in power today in the United States and elsewhere in the world are instructed by the history of the 1930s in a way that I would like to for us not to be instructed, right? So even if you choose to imagine that history doesn't matter at all, there are always people out there who are nostalgic for the darker periods of history, and they might well be in power. In fact, at the moment, they are.
Timothy Snyder, you've mentioned the idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that our country is somehow unique and different from all others. What's the problem with that idea?
The problem with exceptionalism is that it's like wearing a pair of blinders. You know, everybody's unique, right? I mean, every country is unique. The only thing, you know, the thing about exceptionalism is that it's universal. Everything is exceptional. And once you recognize that, then you can be a little bit calmer about your own nation. The problem with exceptionalism in moments like this is that putting those blinders on can mean that you don't see things that are coming at you. from the sides or from the back, threats or history coming back. If you say that, for example, American democracy is going to be American democracy because it's always been American democracy, then you're denying yourself of the sense of urgency that you need. If you say that it can't happen here, you're making it happen here. We're at a moment where one's actions, the actions of American citizens, are more important than they would ordinarily be. Gestures, words, everyday decisions that might not have mattered 3 years ago and hopefully won't matter so much 3 years from now matter an awful lot. So if you say it can't happen here, you're choosing. You're choosing not to do anything. You're making it more likely that it will happen here. If you say American institutions are so wonderful, they will save us automatically, you're undermining those very institutions, because the whole point is those institutions are under attack, and therefore they need help from American citizens. So exceptionalism is a bit of a trap. I mean, it's important to be proud of one's country. Be a patriot is lesson 19 in the book. But if you want one's country to be its best, especially at moments like this, you have to act on your own.
Another kind of exception you talk about in the book is that laid out by the Nazi legal theorist Carl Schmitt. What does Schmitt's example teach us?
His big idea was that politics starts from enemies and friends, so that's the only meaningful political distinction, and that political sovereignty means that you can declare a state of exception. So he has a book called Political Theology, and the first sentence of that book is, the sovereign is the one who can declare a state of exception. So this is important as a kind of politics, because what he's saying is all the laws, all the rules, all the customs, all the traditions, all the practices, those aren't real. All that's real at the end of the day is the power to discard all of that, the power to say, from now on, we're in a different world where there are going to be new rules. And of course, the thing that Schmitt is going to have in mind after 1933 is the moment when Hitler was able to have a state of exception declared. Hitler comes to power in February 1933, but he's still the chancellor of a republic. Then there's a terrorist attack, and Hitler declares a state of emergency, a state of exception, or he has it declared. The president formally declares it. And after that, you basically have a Nazi regime. So the notion that something happens and therefore you can cast all the rules aside, that's part of the template of building a modern tyrannical regime. It's a good example of going back to your first question, of how history instructs. We can choose not to worry about states of exception, but every aspiring tyrant in the world, including Steve Bannon, including Donald Trump, know this template. They know that if there's something like a terrorist attack, they can use that as an excuse to declare a state of exception.
Yes, and in fact, we've already seen that in the United States with the, in some ways, destruction of habeas corpus and the rule of law after 9/11.
So, and I mean, now's a good time to think about 9/11, because 9/11 is a good example of how Americans failed on a couple of important fronts that are very relevant now. We failed to be serious truth seekers about the relationship, or rather the non-relationship, between Iraq, the country that we invaded, and the terrorist attacks of 2001. We, meaning the broader public, we, meaning a great deal of the press, we, meaning the political class, the parts that were in power and some of the parts that weren't. That's not a mistake we can afford to make again. We're now being confronted with a full-on assault on the idea of truth as such, led by the White House, which has become a kind of mendacity industrial complex. If we're not serious about the everyday truth, if we don't support the good investigative journalists working at the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Guardian or other places, we're going to be sunk. The other test of 9/11 is, as you say, the test of the state of exception. We failed then too. We didn't take seriously enough our own freedoms. We got a bit lucky, I'd put it this way, in that our very bad leadership at the time was not as bad as the leadership we have today. So if you look back at our reactions to 9/11, we have to realize if there's something like that again, God forbid, or any kind of horrible, shocking event on the territory of the U.S., it's quite likely that the current leadership will reach for more than the Bush-Cheney team did in 2001, that they will reach for something like a state of exception, that they will ask us to turn over our rights. And so it's very exception that we recognize that this is not only a possibility that it could happen, but that this is a whole pattern of politics. in the whole 20th century. We've had terrorism for the whole 20th century. It was actually the age of terror. The first age of terror was the early 20th century. We've had terrorism for the whole 20th century, and modern authoritarians, usually right-wing, but not always. Stalin did this as well. Modern authoritarians seize on moments of fear of terrorism in order to create authoritarian regimes. That is a pattern of politics. We have to see it as a pattern and then recognize if there's a terrorist attack, our emotions are part of a pattern and we have to break it. We can't let our fear and grief prevent us from defending our own rights if there's a terrorist attack here.
Yes, and another thing that tyrants use, as you point out in the book, Timothy Snyder, and On Tyranny, is that they use our very institutions in order to come to power themselves, and that we put a trust in those institutions that may be a little bit out of bounds from what they really deserve. So what do we need to do to make sure that our institutions are in fact robust?
The most basic institution which we rely upon is the institution of the regular election. And it's important to notice that in some of the cases of tyranny that we try to remember, like, for example, Hitler's rise to power, there was an election in the story. The National Socialist Party won the November 1932 elections in Germany, which was one of the reasons why Hitler could come to power. Not the only reason, but it's in the mix. And if we look at the authoritarian regimes around the world today, the majority of them also have an election somewhere in the story. So the way that modern tyrants consolidate regimes has to do with coming to power through elections and then dismantling the system around the elections. Often the elections themselves continue, as they did, in fact, under Nazi Germany, but they are increasingly ritualized and meaningless. So the mistake is to think just because we had an election, the person who won the election cares about a democratic system. It happens over and over again that people like Mr. Trump, who have in fact declared their opposition to the rule of law and their indifference to democratic norms, are elected. And then those people tend to bump up against the walls of the system and to try to change it, which is also true of Mr. Trump. Now, what this means more broadly is that this thing that we call democracy is not just a matter of waiting for every 2 years, every 4 years for there to be an election and then maybe taking part in it. It means that this thing that we call democracy is part of a larger system, a larger constitutional system, a larger rule of law system, which depends not only on the written rules, but also on how we choose to comport ourselves in the meantime. So in lesson two of the book, which is Defend Institutions, I have in mind the constitutional institutions, the judiciary, the legislature. I also have in mind major national institutions like trade unions, for example, labor unions, newspapers. But it's also very important to realize that our professional institutions, whether we're journalists or lawyers or civil servants or doctors, are very important. Regimes can only change when people forget about professional ethics. So now is a time for people to take professional ethics particularly seriously. Likewise, non-governmental organizations, whether they're directly political or not, form a kind of layer between the government and the individual, preventing that situation where the government faces off against the lone individual, which is romantic, but the lonely individual is always going to lose. Freedom is not just freedom of association. Freedom happens because of association. If we spend time with people who have similar political or non-political interests, if we do things with them, we affirm ourselves, we affirm them, and we create a layer of politics between the rulers and ourselves. So institutions in all of those senses are very important.
I kept on thinking as I was reading your book that haven't we seen a slow motion attack on government institutions and democracy through the last several decades? I mean, we can talk about Citizens United and the capture of the state by corporate interests. We can talk about voter suppression efforts by the Republicans that have been extremely successful. We can talk about the hacking of electronic voting machines, no matter who does them, whether it comes from domestic or international agents. You know, we find ourselves at a time when our own democratic institutions have already been eroded. Can we regain the ground and how?
Yeah, and that's a wonderful question. So to start off, I want to say something which is going to sound a little simple and naive, which is that I think democracy is a good idea. I'm not cynical about democracy. I think democratic elections produce better outcomes than non-democratic elections or non-democratic systems, not only in terms of freedom, but also in terms of prosperity. I think that were the American system more democratic, we would also get better outcomes. You mentioned Citizens United, which, you know, ensconces the completely ridiculous principle that money should, you know, essentially count for more votes. As everyone knows, it does. You mentioned voter suppression, which is a problem. The Electoral College is also an undemocratic institution because it means that a voter in one state can have a vote that counts for dozens of times as much as a voter in another state. Gerrymandering, no matter who does it, is also undemocratic. If you're in Ohio, for example, today, and you're a Democrat, your vote counts for roughly half as much as though a Republican. So for all these reasons, all of those examples, the money, the Electoral College, the gerrymandering, the voter suppression, move us away from a one-person, one-vote system. So democracy in America would be a good thing. It's an aspiration. It's something that we have to get to. Now, a second point that you make that I want to expand on is the attack on government. We can disagree about how much government we need, but we do actually need a government. We do actually have to have politics. And one thing which the American right has fallen into is the habit of saying that whatever goes wrong, it's the fault of the government, even if it's the fault of international capitalism, even if it's the fault of the weather, whatever it might be, it turns out that it's fundamentally the government's fault. That's not what government is. Government is there precisely because economics is unpredictable, or for that matter, because the weather is unpredictable, the world is unpredictable, and government is that set of rules and that set of protections which allow us to live side by side and hopefully be free and prosper all the same. So it makes no sense. We can disagree about exactly what government should do, but attacking government and getting into the mental habit of blaming government for everything is ultimately toxic for us and will drive us down. Now, when it comes to the foreign intervention, I mean, this is something which is being investigated, but it is, I think, rather important if you're a citizen of the United States and you believe not just in democracy, but just in the sovereignty of your country, to take this issue very seriously indeed. For me, this book is a kind of homecoming. What I really do is I really work on Eastern Europe. I work on the darker chapters of European history. I know Russian, I know Ukrainian, I know Polish. Until the last few months, I spent much more time in those languages, German too, French, than I did in English. And the notion that Russia would try to intervene and undo democracy is completely familiar to me because that's been underway for the last 5 years. This goes back to exceptionalism. We only notice it when it happens to us, and we think, oh, how is that possible? Maybe that's some kind of crazy conspiracy. Maybe it's just the left-wing media. No, that has been Russia's consistent and very sober and very effective foreign policy for the last half decade. So let's just get used to the fact that it happens in the world, and it very likely happened to us. And I mean, for me, it's not just a question of democracy working. It's a question of the basic honor of the republic. Is it okay if foreign powers decide who rules us? I think it's not. But ultimately, my answer to your question is that I agree. We have to get much better. And the 20 lessons that I try to lay out in the book are meant to be things that not only will help us get through the moment of crisis we're in, but will also train us to become better citizens. Because, of course, you know, the solution is not to go back to 2016. The solution is to have a much healthier civil society. That's ultimately what the book is about.
Yes, and I want to get onto that. But I also want to note that it's probably a good idea, if we want to stand to the high moral ground, that we also should not interfere in other people's elections, which I think has been also part of U.S. foreign policy. However, the first rule is do not obey in advance. And you refer to the policy of Gleichschaltung in Germany. So tell us about the rule and explain what happened in Germany.
Yeah, rule number one, do not obey in advance, is the most important of all. It's the most important of all because it arises from one of the things that we historians think we understand about 1933 and Nazi Germany, and which political scientists and other scholars believe they understand about other authoritarian regime changes. Namely, at the beginning, the people who aspire to do away with republics and create authoritarian regimes need the consent of the people. They don't need it necessarily in outward forms such as marches or even voting, but they need consent in the sense of people looking away, people drifting along with the new ideas, people not objecting, people looking away as institutions begin to be attacked or as minorities begin to be attacked. That's a very special form of consent. Now, the thing that we also know from sociology and psychology is that that behavior, the obeying in advance, is normal. And in most situations, it's appropriate. So we're conducting a phone interview. We both know you're going to ask questions. I'm going to answer questions. That's completely normal. It's normal that when you walk into a new room or into a party or into a meeting, you adjust to the basic rules of the situation. Being a citizen, though, means recognizing that you're in a special moment where that kind of adjustment, that kind of implicit or subconscious self-adjustment to the new situation is actually helping a new regime with new ideas to come to power. So being a citizen means recognizing that, and knowing the history that this is how republics die can help us to recognize that. So it's also number one for another reason, which is that if you can't get number one, that don't obey in advance, then lessons 2 through 20 become irrelevant. If you do obey in advance, if you say, oh, this is normal, it's not a big deal, this is not a major change, I'm going to wait till my friends do something, I'm going to wait till the newspapers are sure. If you do that, then you change yourself psychologically. Once you've taken the first step to say, this is normal, it's extremely hard, in fact, virtually impossible to undo that first step. And then politically, the timing is incredibly important. If you miss the opportunity to not obey in advance, then you use the first weeks and months to tell yourself it's normal. And by then, even if you do persuade yourself that you should do something, it's much harder to act. The first few weeks and months, the first year basically, where we are now, is crucial. If you decide, I'm just going to wait and see, if you decide, this is normal, then what you end up doing is changing yourself internally in a way that you probably never would have expected because you become a much less free person. And you also blow the chance of making a difference at a crucial historical moment. So that's don't obey in advance.
Yes, and then there's another one which I think follows on what you just said, and that is be wary of paramilitaries, because we know that there was resistance, maybe not enough, but there was resistance to the Nazis. In Holland there was the February general strike that was against the Nazi occupation, but it got fiercely put down. So I wonder if you could talk about this and how do we harden ourselves against the terror from the right?
Yeah, so let me start a slightly different way, which is why paramilitaries are risky in general. I'll come back to left and right, but there's a basic principle here, which is that if you're in a rule of law state, there have to be organs of government whose job it is to enforce the law. They're not going to be perfect. You know, they can be subject to abuse and so on and so forth, but the government has a monopoly on legal force. That's something that we take for granted. You know, if vigilantes appeared on your street, you would think that it's unusual. I mean, I guess depending on where you live in America, but in general, you would think that would be unusual. The way that paramilitaries operate, therefore, is at a very fundamental level. If people get used to the idea that the state doesn't monopolize violence, that there are other institutions out there that also have the right to use violence, then the government is no longer the government. The government blurs, the government wavers, the government becomes the kind of thing that we're not accustomed to. That's one of the elements of Hitler's rise to power. It's also, for that matter, one of the elements of the Bolshevik Revolution and other authoritarian regime changes. You have a paramilitary. You keep it out on the streets, use it to resist the government, use it to beat up your enemies, use it to intimidate the population. And then, and this is the German case, once you have an election, you keep those guys going, and they continue to change the political atmosphere. And then you use them for special tasks, which are maybe illegal. But then what was once illegal starts to become normal over time. In Germany, the classic example is the concentration camp. So that's why, in general, one has to be concerned about paramilitaries. In the U.S. now, where the vast majority of paramilitary activity is on the right, I mean, on various kinds of right, the same principle holds. If one is, for example, in Portland, Oregon, one should be very concerned about the possibility of paramilitaries taking part or supplanting the police in preserving, quote-unquote, order in public demonstrations. If one is a citizen of the United States, one should be very concerned that at Mr. Trump's rallies, he used his private security detail very much the same way that fascists did in the 1920s and 1930s, and then that Mr. Trump expressed the desire to keep his private security detail going when he was president of the United States. That's a basic clash with how the rule of law is supposed to work. If one considers the recent firing of FBI Director James Comey, notice how it was carried out. Mr. Trump sent the head of his private security detail, Mr. Schiller, to go personally fire Mr. Comey. So these are all symptoms of people, either from the paramilitary side or from the executive branch of the United States government, trying to permeate trying to break through, trying to weaken this basic line, which says, there has to be a threat of violence, it has to be legal. Paramilitaries are a threat to that basic idea, and so they're one fundamental threat to the kind of state that we take for granted.
What about the issue of military contractors and private prisons? Because it seems to me that these, we already kind of have a mercenary army in place. And in fact, Eric Prince, I think, is a pretty close confidant of the president. And he was, of course, the head of Blackwater, which then morphed into other names. So if you privatize the army and the police and the prisons, what happens to democracy?
Yeah. On Tyranny is a very short book, and I only refer to a few aspects of contemporary American reality, but I do refer to those examples in the little section about paramilitaries. Just for the reason that you give, it's not proper for us to privatize the military. It breaks up the chain of command. It's unfair to the men and women in uniform who find themselves paid less very often than private contractors doing the same thing. It creates uncertainty in the relationship between our votes as citizens and the actions of the people who represent the United States government abroad. It also creates a class of people who have an uncertain relationship to the government. The same can be said about the private prisons, to which there are other objections. So it used to be that, you know, everyone would agree that the police and the army should be part of the government, and then we might disagree about other things. We've now reached the point where a good deal of police and military functions have been privatized. I can only agree with you that I think this is a very bad thing, and it ought to be rolled back. If the government's going to use violence or threaten violence or accumulate the means of violence, it has to be as the government and not as something else. And then the other thing that you hint at, and I quite agree, is that once you have private prisons or private military forces, those things then become meaningful lobbies on their own, right? So if you mention Eric Prince, what does it mean that when the president is seeking secret channels of communication with a foreign power, namely Russia, it's Eric Prince who is sent out to a mysterious island in the Indian Ocean to try to make contact? What it means is that these private military forces, or the people who represent them, are in the center of government decision-making, taking covert actions which have no relationship to anything that the public is ever meant to find out about. And that's obviously a problem.
We talked in the beginning about the politics of inevitability, the idea that democracy is inevitable. You also talk about the politics of eternity, and you contrast it to that. Tell us what that means.
So with the politics of inevitability and the politics of eternity, I'm really just trying to get across the idea that history is real and history matters, that history is out there for us to learn from, but we have to acknowledge it, and we have to be a little humble, and we have to learn. I think history is extremely empowering if we let it be, and the purpose of the book is to crystallize some lessons from difficult periods of history into a form that most Americans could follow most of the time. But history can only be useful to us if we're open to history. The politics of inevitability and the politics of eternity are kind of historical masquerades. They're ways that we claim to be paying attention to the past, but they're actually ways of being unhistorical. So with the politics of inevitability, what I have in mind is the idea, which is very widespread in this country, unfortunately, that history somehow ended in 1989 when communism came to an end, you know, that human nature means capitalism, capitalism means democracy, therefore, whatever the facts seem to be, however many exceptions keep racking up, that therefore we can just count on things moving in a certain direction. Everything's going to be fine. And that also means we don't have to really remember the concepts or the details about the past, because all that stuff in the past is just there to move us towards this inevitable story about the future. The great irony about that is that the reason that we think history came to an end is because communism came to an end, but communism came to an end because its story about the future is wrong. Our story about the future is wrong, too. All stories about the future are wrong, and they disarm you. They make you vulnerable. And then when a shock comes, you don't really know what to say because you've already said, I know what the future holds, but what if you're wrong? And you've already said, well, we don't really need to know about the past, but when shocks come, you really, really do need to know about the past. So one of these shocks was the election of November of 2016. And I could see and feel, and this is why I wrote about it, how people were slipping from that notion of inevitability to something else, which I call the politics of eternity. What the politics of eternity is the idea that things just keep happening, that history is a kind of cycle. And this is a very dangerous idea, because it means you go from being sure that the future is going to be good to being sure that the future is going to be bad, that the same bad things just come around again and again, that the nation is virtuous, but it's vulnerable to outside attacks, and therefore you just have to be ready for outside attacks. So this is very much the politics of Mr. Trump, Mr. Bannon, the Make America Great Again, you know, where the again is really about the 1930s, and trying to get back to a sense of the rest of the world as a threat, of refugees as a threat, migrants as a threat, world economics as a threat, everything as a threat. Whether or not our leaders actually believe in this, what it does is it creates a kind of politics where everything is of the moment. So if we are constantly under all kinds of threat, then how can we possibly imagine that we could have reforms that would might make things better? All you can do is panic constantly, and then, you know, your panic will prevent you from noticing that perhaps your health care was just taken away or your Medicaid was just taken away. And how can you complain about those things when there's a constant state of emergency, when the evildoers, the bad hombres, are always on the doorstep? So when I wrote the book, I was concerned about us shifting from one style of thinking about the future and past, which is wrong, to another style of thinking about future and past, which is also wrong and more dangerous. And what I was trying to do is to insert history between them, to say, look, we're at a historical moment of great significance. If we pause and think for a second and realize what the bad possibilities are, but also what the good actions are, what the historical limits are, but also what the historical possibilities are. If we see this moment and therefore see our own responsibility in this moment and for this moment, there's an awful lot that we can actually do if we choose to. So we have to shake out of the inevitability, shake out of the eternity, and take responsibility. And the book is basically a manual of that. It's a set of examples of people who did take responsibility, and it shows what they have learned and what they can teach us.
Historian Timothy Snyder talking with Writer's Voice in 2017. Snyder is professor of history at Yale University. He is the author of several previous books, including Bloodlands and Black Earth. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.